Chapter 8. The quartet of men-at-arms, standing watch in the guard-room, behind the ponderous gates that fronted the massive keep of Duke Merriman's castle, were more attentive than those who had been charged with guarding their master's private chambers. The threat of an intruder was not much greater, but the chance of a sudden inspection by one of Merriman's knights was, and not a man among them did not bear some scar to remind him that any deficiency in their duty would be harshly rewarded. So it was that the four men turned as one when they spied a ragged-looking figure race around the corner of the wide corridor that communicated between the gates and the keep's innards. The four men hurried into the hallway, spears at the ready, blocking the path of the runner standing between him and the open gates.
"Hold!"
the ranking soldier commanded, his hand lifted in an imperious gesture. The ragged man came to a skidding halt before the trooper and his comrades. He gazed at the menacing spear points, then at the glowering, scarred countenances of the men who held them. A smile crawled onto the man's handsome features.
"Praise the lady!"
he cried, his voice carrying such relief and joy that it took the troopers by surprise.
"Then they haven't gotten this far!"
"Who?"
the leader asked, the tip of his spear lowering slightly as it responded to the soldier's distraction.
"Who's not gotten this far?"
"The prisoners!"
the ragged man declared, a note of superiority and disbelief in his voice now, as though he could not believe his interrogator would need to voice such a question.
"There was a riot in the dungeons. Many of the prisoners have escaped and are running loose in the castle. His lordship is even now leading the hunt to track them down."
The man nodded his head once more in relief.
"But it seems that none of them had made it past your vigilance."
"No," the leader said, his tone still displaying the confusion that filled his squinting gaze.
"You're the first person we've seen since Two Bells."
"Excellent."
The stranger clapped his dirty hands together in pleasure.
"Then we may be certain that none of them have escaped this way."
He smiled again, stepping closer to the leading soldier. The other men-at-arms hesitated, uncertain whether they should continue to guard against the man's advance.
"I'll need to spread the alarm to the other guards posted on the outer wall,"
he told the sergeant. The leader cocked his head to one side, hostility dispelling the confusion in his eyes.
"Are you telling me that my men and I can't keep a bunch of half-starved dungeon rats from taking the portal?"
the soldier growled. He looked up and down his accuser, studying his grimy black leather garments and filthy skin.
"For that matter, who by all the gods are you? I've never seen you before."
"Nor have I,"
chimed in one of the other soldiers, his spear poised for a quick thrust into the ragged man's kidneys. Gobineau sighed, then met the suspicious stare of the commanding soldier.
"I am Percival, assistant torturer,"
he announced with a note of pride. Around him, he heard the uneasy shifting of feet that his pronouncement caused. It would explain his dirty garments and unkempt appearance, and unless Merriman had changed vastly over the years, Gobineau knew that his men-at-arms were not exempt from being victims of his dungeons should they fail in their appointed tasks. The threat that they might one day be victims of the evil toys kept in Merriman's torture chamber tended to keep even the most sadistically curious of his soldiers far from the place. He doubted if more than a handful of men within the castle knew what Merriman's torture master looked like, or if the man had any assistants. If Ranald was still being gracious, none of the soldiers he now faced would be one of them. He'd already been lucky in the fact that none of them had been involved in his capture in Merriman's throne room. The leader looked somewhat taken aback by Gobineau's statement, but one of the other soldiers suddenly had a stroke of inspiration, probably the only idea that had entered the man's head in a fortnight.
"How do we know that you aren't one of the prisoners?"
the man-at-arms demanded. Gobineau maintained his smile, while inwardly cursing the god of thieves. Ranald certainly wasn't going to let out of this one easily.
"If I was one of the prisoners, would I run up to an armed of group soldiers, telling them that there had been an escape from the dungeons?"
Gobineau put a withering amount of arrogance and contempt in his tone. The accusing soldier could not maintain Gobineau's stare, glancing down at the floor. Gobineau turned back toward the leader of the guards.
"Now, I must spread word to the other guards. Not as any lack of faith in your ability to hold this portal, which I have the utmost confidence you shall do, but because there is always a chance in their desperation that these wretches might try to climb down the walls from one of the windows."
The explanation satisfied the sergeant, who moved aside, allowing the outlaw to stride past him. Gobineau paused beneath the archway.
"Close these behind me, and be vigilant," he told them, addressing the guards as though he were some mighty general, and they a vast horde of local militia. "The prisoners have armed themselves, and they are quite desperate. Don't take any chances with them. His lordship will be just as pleased with them dead as alive."
A sudden thought occurred to Gobineau, and he grinned.
"Beware of the elf witch," he told the soldiers. "She is the one who freed the prisoners. Don't give her a chance to place a spell on you. If you see her, cut her down as swiftly as you can."
The outlaw turned to withdraw, but the sergeant rushed up beside him. Gobineau bit down on the sudden horror that seized him. Turning, he was surprised to see the soldier proffering him the sword that had formerly rested at the sergeant's side.
"You are unarmed, and if, as you say, some of the prisoners have circumvented our post, you may have need of a weapon,"
the sergeant told him. Gobineau accepted a weapon, bowing his head in gratitude.
"You are a quick thinker, sergeant,"
the rogue told him. "The Duke could use more men of your penetrating intelligence and wisdom." Gobineau allowed a man to bask in the compliment a moment before resuming his sprint across the courtyard. He heard the heavy doors of the keep slam shut behind him. If the guards on the outer wall were as easily duped, he'd be quit of this place in only a few more minutes. Of course, now he had something to fall back upon, should his glib tongue not work its magic twice. Gobineau adjusted his grip on the guard's heavy broadsword. Truly, Ranald provided all things in his own devious way. Even as he saw the outer gatehouse drawing closer, Gobineau turned his thoughts back to what must be unfolding within the castle. He'd studied the elf's secret passage mechanisms well enough during his brief travel through them to use them to effect his own escape after some judicious tampering with the door mechanisms to ensure that the two bounty hunters would not be following him, even if they did survive their battle with the vampire. The rogue had almost been caught himself when he'd emerged from the passage, nearly running headfirst into a large group of men-at-arms and knights, with a furious Merriman at their head, heading toward a room Gobineau had recently quit. Fortunately, they hadn't seen him. He imagined that, even in the unlikely event that Brunner did best the vampiric Sir Corbus, the bounty hunter would hardly be able to fight his way through the force Merriman was bringing. All things considered, Gobineau did not think he'd have to worry about Brunner following him around anymore. The only thing that still puzzled him was the absolute terror the elf witch had shown of the musty old artifact. She had regarded it as though it were the knife of Cain. Gobineau hadn't seen that it possessed any strange powers or the ability to work dark miracles, unless, of course, it had been responsible for Corbus's timely arrival. Yet even as his thoughts turned in this direction, a strange sound impressed itself upon the outlaw, not unlike the soft roar of an ocean wave washing upon a barren shore. The night seemed to have grown strangely warm as well, and Gobineau imagined that the air had gained a curious, acrid odor to it.
"We're getting close now,"
Ithilwale gasped, as she led the way down yet another narrow corridor. Brunner turned his head in her direction for only a moment, then returned his attention to the hallway behind them, his crossbow held at a ready. The bounty hunters could hear their pursuers cautiously advancing to the last corner they had turned. With two of their number already dead, the remaining soldiers of Duke Merrymond were playing things more carefully. Unfortunately, Brunner didn't think they'd stay careful for too long, and if the score or so men chasing them decided to rush them all at once, even if he brought down a man with every shot, it would hardly stem the charge.
"By Grimnir!"
Olgrin snarled from the position beside Brunner, a gleaming hand axe in each grubby fist. The dwarf's huge battle axe had been left behind in Merrymond's private chambers, the dwarf having been too disoriented to think of recovering it until the Duke himself and 24 of his men stood between him and his beloved weapon. But if Olgrin's spirits had been volatile, they were fanned into flames when Ithilwale announced that she knew where the old escape tunnel was located, making the route he had charted superfluous.
"Why did I get myself covered in this filth, if we aren't even going to use that damn tunnel?"
the dwarf spat. "Maybe I just don't feel like paying you extra to kill more frogs." Brunner directed the withering comment at the dwarf, keeping his eyes fixed on the hallway. An armored head briefly darted around a corner, making certain that the persons they were hunting were still in sight. The observer lingered just a second too long, and had his bravery answered by the steel bolt that punched into his forehead. Unseen hands dragged his body back behind the corner.
"Time to move," Brunner told his companions.
He gave Ithilwale a hard look.
"If this escape route of yours isn't close, we're dead. They won't let me pick them off one by one much longer. Pretty soon now, they're going to decide risking a massed charge gives them better odds."
Ithilwale nodded her understanding.
"Only a few more turns, and we will be there," she replied.
It would have been much easier on them if they'd been able to employ the secret passage again, but Ithilwale had been unable to reopen the secret door, stating that someone had sabotaged the mechanism. Gobineau, without question, ensuring that he'd gain time on any pursuit the bounty hunters mounted. The real fiasco had been Olgrin's insistence that he could get the door open again. A few moments of waiting for Olgrin to manage this small miracle had seen Merrymond and his soldiers storming down the corridor toward them. Even the stubborn Olgrin had relented and abandoned his labor when he sighted the armed company racing toward them. The elf witch led the pair around several more twists and turns in the corridor. As they passed a narrow flight of stairs that wound deep into the foundations of the castle, Olgrin hesitated and pointed a stubby finger at the gloom below.
"That's the way we came up,"
Olgrin stated proudly.
"There's no tricking a dwarf when it comes to stonework."
"That's nice," Brunner told him. "But we're going this way," he added, motioning for Ithilwale to lead on. Olgrin spat a foul-sounding Khazalid curse into his beard, but hurried after his companions. "Just around the next turn there is an old storeroom that is never used," Ithilwale told Brunner, as they paused before the mouth of a four-way intersection. "The storeroom has a very large cask inside it, but it is really a door that leads into a tunnel. I followed it as far as its end, but it lets out in the very center of the city. Not a very safe place for me to be." Brunner imagined that the elf's pallid skin colored slightly as she spoke. "At least not without an escort."
"We'll get out of here,"
the bounty hunter assured Ithilwale. "Then we'll pick up that maggot's trail." Brunner tried to give the elf a reassuring smile, but found that he was woefully out of practice.
"Gobineau won't stay free for long."
But as he turned the corner, the sight that greeted the bounty hunter's words made him question the veracity of his last statement. The flickering light of torches cast eerie reflections in the polished steel armor of the half-dozen knights who filled the passageway, flanking the grinning, weasel-faced noblemen standing at their center. Suddenly, the seeming timidity of their pursuers was explained. They weren't supposed to catch the bounty hunters and the elf, but simply herd them into the trap. Keep them looking behind instead of ahead. Brunner cursed his own lack of foresight. He should have expected Marimond to know every inch of his own castle, most especially something as vital as an escape route. The Duke's sneer was as vicious as the toothy grin of a goblin. Marimond considered each of the fugitives in turn, letting his keen, calculating eyes settle on each for a moment before looking on to the next. His eyes blazed briefly with a restrained rage when he stared at Ithilwale. "Most inconsiderate of you to return my hospitality as such." Marimond hesitated, biting down whatever word he had intended to use, selecting a less vituperative replacement. "Malfeasance." Brunner weighed his chances. He still had 3 bolts loaded in his crossbow. That would allow him to kill Marimond, maybe manage one of the knights before the others fell upon him. The bounty hunter discarded the idea. Marimond was the only chance of talking his way out of the standoff. The nobleman stared at the bounty hunter as though reading his thoughts. "You think you can kill me with that disgusting weapon of yours?" Marimond scoffed. "The lady protects her noble children. Have you never heard of the grace she bestows upon the valiant, turning aside the craven arrows of cowardly swine, that they may be forced into honorable combat?" Marimond rapped a knuckle against his own chest. "I am the legitimate ruler of the once proud realm of Musilon. The blessing of the lady flows from my veins. What need have I to fear your filthy arrows?"
"By Grimnir's axe," Olgrin hissed, "is every nobleman in this damn city insane?"
The dwarf's outburst caused a flicker of discomfort to cross Merriman's face, then a cold fury to smolder in his eyes.
"Kill them,"
Merriman declared, waving a hand at the knights around him. The armored warriors started to move forward. In that instant, Brunner acted, firing his crossbow at the only target that would possibly have an effect. Marimond crumpled in a screaming heap, his sword fallen to the floor beside him as he clamped both hands at a steel bolt protruding from his knee. Several of the knights immediately turned away from Brunner and his companions, rushing back to aid their master. The bounty hunter turned and raced back the way they had come, the feet pounding to either side of him, telling him that Ithilwale and Olgrin had not hesitated in following his lead. Behind them, the clatter of armor told Brunner that some of Merriman's knights had ignored their lord's cries, intent on following his last command. Still, at least a few of them would be detained, helping their injured master. With Merriman dead, they would have had all the knights on their tail, focused on avenging their slain lord. This way, at least the odds were somewhat reduced. Now, if they could just reach Olgrin's tunnel without running into the troops that had been herding them toward Merriman. Merriman snapped at the men carrying him away from the scene of his wounding, lashing them with his tongue every time a fresh trickle of pain surged through his body. He'd have that filthy assassin's body carved into dog meat, and his head would rot upon a pike until the flesh turned black beneath the sun. The audacity of the dog to strike him, him, with his filthy coward's weapon! And the anguish he would visit upon the assassin's remains would be nothing compared to what he would do to that elf witch. Merriman dearly hoped that at least she would be taken alive. His knights were zealous in their work, and an elf witch, a single assassin, and some odd-looking shit-covered gnome were hardly going to give them a decent fight. But at least they would know it was by Merriman's command that they died, and that was just as good as the nobleman's own sword, accomplishing the deed. A foul, acrid stench impressed itself upon the Duke, causing him to forget his pain for a moment, so strong and unsettling was the odor. Merriman wondered for a moment if something might not be burning in one of the rooms of the castle, perhaps some feeble attempt by Ithilwail to distract him and his men from the pursuit. But the Duke did not have long to consider the thought, for he suddenly had much more important things to consider as the corridor around him shook and swayed as though he were within a ship at sea. The knights carrying him fell against the walls as the castle shuddered, dropping their noble burden to the floor. Merriman screamed anew as his maimed leg struck the hard flagstones. Merriman began to lift himself from the floor when the castle shook again, knocking him flat once more. The impact was vastly more powerful this time, as though someone were hurling massive boulders into the side of the fortress. Merriman could hear the heavy stone blocks groaning and grinding against one another, thick trails of dust raining down from the ceiling overhead. He covered his head as the roof began to give way, rocks and heavy blocks of stone tumbling downward now. Again the castle shook, as some incredible force shook it. The Duke had seen mighty hurricanes sweep across Mousillon, and those relentless tempests had not even evoked a fraction of the force now assaulting his home. The realization of what must be happening dawned on Merriman just as the corridor shook again and the walls collapsed around him. The guards in the tower that rose from the north wall of Merriman's castle only just had time to scream before they died, as they witnessed the gigantic crimson shape that had fallen upon them from the night sky. Claws the size of ox carts had gripped the fortification, talons sinking into the stonework as though it were crafted from soft clay. Without losing any of its momentum, the swooping fiend had ripped the top of the tower free, spilling tiny figures from its battlements, and with a graceful motion had turned its sudden descent, ascending back into the firmament once more. But as it did so, the massive claws flung the broken tower at the brooding mass of the keep, lending it some of the ghastly power of the creature's momentum. The immense weight of the tower smacked into the side of Merriman's castle with the force of a dozen catapults, rupturing its northern face like the shell of an egg. Then, as suddenly as it had come, the huge shape disappeared once more, vanishing from sight as it was consumed by the night. Behind it, it left a foul, mephitic smell, like the musk of serpents mixed with the stink of charcoal. The few soldiers, standing gap-mouthed on the outer walls of the castle, could not believe what they had seen, doubting their very sanity. All had happened so quickly, it was hard to believe it had happened at all. It was a man-at-arms in the south tower who saw the first flicker of fire shine out from the blackness above. Soon, all eyes were watching as the flame hurtled downward, speeding toward the keep. There was no shout of alarm, no cry of terror. Somehow, the soldiers had a sense that what they were witnessing was far too big for fear. They watched in awed silence as the flame became more distinct in its descent, as it resolved itself into a fiery steam billowing out from the jaws of a gigantic visage. The hurtling leviathan crashed onto the top of the keep, and the awed silence was shattered by the shriek of wood and the rumble of stone. A vast cloud of grey dust blossomed about the immense creature, engulfing it for a moment like some grainy fog. Then the dust fell away, and the watching soldiers were about to scream and shout, every voice crying the same word.
A dragon!
It was vast, gigantic. 200 feet from the tip of his snout to the pointed barb that terminated his immense tail. The dragon wore crimson scales upon his limbs and sides, fading into a thick armor of black bony plates upon his back. From these plates rose a rank of sharp spines, like a column of pikemen, their wicked points gleaming in the flickering glow of the dragon's exhalations. Each of the worm's legs was massive, thick as a tree trunk, and bulging beneath its scaly covering with muscle and power. From its shoulders, colossal wings were stretched, great leathery pinions set in a framework of finger-like bones. The dragon's head leered before his body, supported upon a neck as thick as a river barge, long black horns stabbing back away from the face from just above the sunken sockets of his cold, yellow eyes. From the crater-like nostrils, an orange smoke wafted, illuminating the mighty beast and casting eerie shadows upon the enormous jaws beneath the dragon's head. Rank upon rank of jagged teeth, each longer than a man's arm, shone out from their setting of crimson scales. The observers had one and all heard the legends of noble knights riding forth to slay marauding drakes, rescuing fair damsels and golden treasures from the caves of such scaly monsters. Such stories were common in the lore and legend of Bretonnia, and well known to even the poorest of the peasants. But none had ever seen the creatures spoken of in those tales, perhaps taking comfort in believing such beasts to be a part of the history of their land, rather than something that might return in their own time. As terror overcame the awe that had gripped the hearts of the soldiers, the men-at-arms scrambled over one another in their haste to be quit of the battlements, to abandon the fortress to the legendary horror that had fallen upon it from the grim night sky. Malloc paid the fleeing soldiers little notice, intent upon pulverizing the stone structure beneath him. The dragon's impact had shaken the very foundations of the keep, though the tough body of the worm had felt little of his violent collision with the unyielding fortification. Now he brought his heavy clawed legs, smashing again and again into the cracked rubble that roofed the structure, causing the already weakened stonework to shudder and groan. Malloc could feel the castle shifting beneath him as rooms and corridors collapsed below, shifting tons of stone to crush the little vermin within. The dragon reared his head back, roaring into the night, a sound like the scream of hot steel thrust into icy snow, magnified to such a degree that the eardrums of the human witnesses threatened to burst under such duress. Gouts of flame, like the explosions of a blast furnace, flashed from Malloc's jaws, staining the night sky a hellish hue. The dragon maintained his violent, boastful display of wrath and retribution for a lingering moment, letting his display of power build until he could feel the fiery heat swelling within him. Then the dragon turned his head downward, expelling a long stream of golden flame into the structure beneath his feet. Wooded support beams exploded as the dragon fire consumed them, turning oak and pine into ash and steam. The already weakened pile caved in beneath the reptile as the supports were destroyed. 3 floors of the castle crumpled, crushing downward, pushing outward against the walls. Malok beat his wings, lifting himself free as the castle disintegrated into a pile of rock and debris, smoke and dust billowing about him as the mighty wings caused the air to swirl and writhe. The hovering dragon glared down at his handiwork, reptilian eyes narrowing into dagger-like slits as he contemplated the destruction. Deciding it was not enough, Malok drew in another breath, expelling a second stream of flame into the rubble, sending tons of stone exploding into the air as the fiery column struck. The dragon snarled down at the rubble, a deep and satisfied hiss, then wheeled away, now intent on attending to all the tiny little vermin who had been running away from the curtain wall and guard towers. After all, any one of them might be the one who had driven the dragon to come here. And that was a summons Malok was not going to let pass unanswered.
"This should be far enough,"
Olgrin announced, his eyes narrowing as he studied the black muck-crusted brickwork overhead.
"We're past the keep now. Nothing to come down about our heads now. Except, of course, the courtyard,"
the dwarf added with a morbid chuckle. Much to the annoyance of his companions, Olgrin seemed to be almost enjoying himself as they crawled through the filthy, cramped confines of the tunnel. Brunner suspected a change in Olgrin's attitude had much to do with the fact that his companions were so clearly discomfited by their circumstances. While the low ceiling of the tunnel made Olgrin walk with a slight stoop, it forced the much taller Brunner and Ithilwale to creep along almost bent double, their hands groping into the muck coating the walls to maintain their balance. The dwarf's almost supernatural ability to sense the pressure of the stone above them had been the only real guide as to how far they had come, and how far they might yet have to go before reaching the exit. They had reached the tunnel well ahead of the heavily armored knights Marimond had sent after them, but they didn't have much of a lead over their pursuers. The knights of Bretonnia, for all their arrogance and pride, were still some of the most dangerous warriors any land had to offer. In their armor plate, only the most powerful or expertly aimed blows had any hope of wounding the knight within, nor was the warrior likely to stand still while the enemy attempted such a strike. Their style was far more direct and brutal than the elaborate feint and deceive flourishes of Tylea's duelists, but the swordsmanship of a Bretonnian knight was no less intimidating, something Brunner felt better challenging from 50 paces away with a crossbow than in the cramped confines of a dungeon, where room to maneuver was limited and every advantage lay with the knight. The bounty hunters had decided that the only course of action upon gaining the dank tunnel was to wait out their pursuers and strike them down as they tried to follow, a tactic which, if ill will, opposed as being utterly base and cowardly. Neither Brunner and Olgrin paid the slightest interest to her moral complaints. This was the real world, not some duel between princes in an elven court with all its rules of etiquette and tradition. There were trained, well-armed killers pursuing them, men who would strike them down without the slightest hesitation should they catch them. The bounty hunters were determined not to give them such an opportunity. The first knight, almost crawling as he progressed through the narrow tunnel, his helmet removed in order that he might not be rendered completely blind, had found himself surprised by Olgrin when the dwarf's axe bit cleanly through the warrior's mail coif and the neck beneath. The night following the decapitated man rose in alarm, his mouth opening to give voice to a cry of warning. The sound was silenced when a bolt from Brunner's crossbow sank into the knight's forehead. After that, the pursuers had shown a bit more caution. They must have been joined by the larger company that had herded the bounty hunters toward Merrymond, for the next men sent crawling through the dank tunnel were lightly armored squires rather than bulky knights in plate mail. Brunner and Olgrin waded further into the passage, weapons ready to repeat their grim labors. Then the walls shook. The tremor was followed by others, far greater in strength and ferocity. All within the tunnel could hear the crash of stone and the screams of doomed men and women sounding from the castle. The groan and roar of toppling stone grew into a dull, almost organic thing, pounding against their ears with such violence that it seemed determined to deafen all who were victim of it. The squires, who had been sent into the tunnel, scrambled forward like panicked rats, scurrying from a sinking ship. They had been closer to the mouth of Olgrin's tunnel, and had heard, more distinctly, the noise of their comrades being crushed beneath tons of stone. In their heedless flight, the squires found themselves easy prey for the waiting blades of Brunner and Olgrin. It was not a fight, it was a slaughter. But the bounty hunters had done far worse in their black careers than take advantage of disoriented foes. The slaying of the squires would be forgotten almost as soon as it was achieved. Then another tremor shook the castle, and the rumble of stone sounded from much nearer. The high-pitched death shriek of a squire, cagey enough to linger back while his fellows met the blades of the two bounty killers, told a terrifying story. The tunnel was collapsing behind them. The three fugitives began a mad scramble back down the dismal corridor, struggling to stay ahead of the roar behind them. Olgrin, with a long history of mining, and the cave-ins that are the constant worry of the miner, was better able to judge the nearness of the collapse. His words of gruff, oath-strewn encouragement lent a new speed to Brunner and Ithilwale's tired legs. It was the elf who spoke now, wiping some of the muck from her soiled garments with as much dignity as the cramped confines of the tunnel would allow.
"It came,"
she said, her voice heavy with resignation.
"The fool called it and it came."
"What came?"
Brunner asked, his voice low and cautious.
"The dragon that is bound to the Fell Fang,"
Ithilwale responded.
"It must have been very near to have come so swiftly. And that fool called it, without any idea of what he summoned or how to control it."
"Are you saying a dragon caused the cave-in?"
Olgrin demanded. Ithilwale nodded her head in response.
"By now, in its fury, it must have reduced Merrymond's castle to a pile of rubble," she stated.
The two bounty hunters stared at Ithilwale as though struggling to grasp the magnitude of the power her words bestowed upon the creature.
"Then that's the end of our hunt,"
Olgrin snarled, smacking a fist against the tunnel wall.
"Unless you have a few months to try and dig his bones out from under tons of rock."
"Maybe," Brunner told his partner. "But maybe not. Don't forget, Gobineau was no friend of Merriman's either. He wasn't just trying to escape from us, but from the castle in general."
The bounty hunter paused, considering his own words.
"I think that, with Merrymond distracted by ourselves, our rather valuable friend might have gone a bit further than we did."
Olgrin's eyes lit as the possibility that Gobineau yet survived was presented to him. At the same time, Ithilwale's expression became one of dread.
"We must make certain,"
she declared.
"We have to be sure he is dead."
She looked deeply into the eyes of first Brunner and then Olgrin Balax.
"Don't you understand? If Gobineau is still alive, and he still has the Fell Fang, then this horror might occur again. Any time, any place."
Noting the stone-cold expressions of both killers, Ithilwale's voice became more imploring.
"It might be one of your own cities next time. Your own people crushed beneath its feet or incinerated by its breath."
Brunner let the elf speak, then shook his head.
"We'll find Gobineau, dead or alive. But not for your reasons. This talisman that calls dragons is your concern. The price on Gobineau's head is ours. As I said before, so long as you don't get in the way, you're welcome to tag along."
The bounty hunter tossed aside the kettle helm that formed part of his guard's disguise and replaced his own steel sallet helm over his features. Without another word, Brunner began to make his way forward once again. Olgrin paused to regard Ithilwale for a moment before hurrying after his partner.
"And don't get any funny ideas about sharing the bounty,"
the dwarf growled.
"The shares aren't big enough the way things are. I'll be a grub-eyes wet nurse if I let them shrink even more because of a tall ear."
Duke Merrimond was dying. With each breath, a fresh bubble of gore dripped from his chin. He could feel the broken wreckage of his ribs, the cracked ruin that had once been his pelvis. Every inch of the would-be ruler of Musilon was agony. Crushed beneath the walls of his own fortress, the nobleman's vision now swam, black and red dots flaring over the dust and rubble that reason told him he should see. Merrimond could not imagine what could have been responsible for the destruction of his inviolate fortress. It had withstood storm and earthquake and even siege, but now, in less time than he would have believed possible, the castle had been stamped into ruin and all his dreams of power crushed along with it. Was this the judgment of the gods? Had he, far from being chosen by the lady, been cursed by her? Was he in reality the evil heretic, Malford, rather than the legendary hero, Landuin? Even as the mangled duke considered the renowned Landuin first lord of Musilon, his thoughts strayed to the mighty deeds the legendary knight had accomplished. And suddenly, Merrimond knew what force had destroyed him. Landuin had slain a dragon among the mighty feats of his long career. The adulterous wretch, Gobineau, had brought a strange old artifact with him, a device he claimed would call dragons to the one who wielded it. At once, the nobleman recalled the horrific sound he had heard, or imagined that he had heard, a malefic roar bellowing behind the rumble of falling walls and collapsing floors. Merrimond's lip twisted into a sneer. So, Gobineau's claim had been more than a frantic telltale to save his hide. A shape slowly manifested itself above him. Merrimond's vision flickered, but slowly he began to understand that the shape was that of a man, one of his knights. Sir Corbus was without his crimson armor now, clad only in a long wool shrift, his pale skin exposed. The knight's face was a grotesque ruin, one eye socket expanded in a ghastly and hideous manner, one jaw blasted and broken by some terrible force. Still, despite his horrible injuries, Merrimond's most loyal follower had come to him. The nobleman tried to crawl toward his savior, but found that he could only move his left arm. Corbus stood very near the trapped Merrimond, staring down at him with a single, baleful eye. The vampire's broken jaws worked to create a dry, hissing sort of speech.
You were speaking,
the blood dragon said. Merriman closed his eyes, trying to remember. Had he been speaking? Was his delirium such that reason had flown from his tongue? The vampire leaned down, his hideously ruined face only inches from Merriman's own.
Tell me more about this man who has the power to summon dragons.
Merriman blinked. Why would Corbus concern himself with such things when his lord and master was dying at his own feet? The nobleman opened his mouth to remind the knight of his oaths and vows, but staring into the burning eye of Corbus, Merriman felt his soul shudder. For the first time, the would-be lord of Musilon understood just how abominable a creature he had allowed to take service with him. Instead of calling for the vampire's help, the nobleman gasped out a name.
Gobineau,
he said, bloody froth punctuating his words. Corbus smiled with what was left of his face. Gobineau. He had seen that wretch with the assassin and that traitor elf bitch in Merriman's chambers. So, it was Gobineau who had this power, this ability to summon the mighty dragons of earth and sky. The vampire let a low hiss of expectancy and depraved lust slither through the wound in his throat. Finding the thief would be the first step toward the only salvation left for one of his diseased kind, the only way of ending his disgusting curse and redeeming his lost honor. Corbus looked back at the trapped Merriman.
Gobineau,
the vampire repeated.
Thank you, Merriman.
Corbus continued, speaking his former master's name without hint of deference or respect. The vampire's eye fixed upon the froth bubbling from the nobleman's mouth. His long wolf-like tongue flicked back and forth and licked his dagger-like fangs.
There is just one more thing you can do for me,
Corbus whispered, leaning toward the trapped man so that he might feed. From the darkness of his bolt hole, Gobineau cast his eyes skyward, trying to pierce the haze of smoke and darkness for another glimpse of the fearsome form that had descended out of the night. His body still shivered as he remembered the sight, the huge reptile, clad in its armor of crimson scales, borne aloft by its midnight wings. No fresh young worm, this mighty destroyer that had answered the rogue's call, but a monster hoary with the crust of age and legend. Gobineau had been able to get a good look at the dragon as it rose from the rubble of Merriman's castle, soaring low above the castle grounds and the surrounding district. It was enormous, its scales scarred and dulled by the relentless march of time. The gigantic drake bore the marks of its long and terrible life as a great patch of blackened flesh marked its left shoulder and the side of its neck. Along its side ran a deep trench-like scar, as though some titan had wrecked the tip of his sword along the dragon's belly. Yet such old injuries did not seem to disturb or slow the malevolent creature as it rose into the night sky. Its cruel yellow eyes scoring the landscape for the tiny fleeing figures that had scattered before its fury. Gobineau clasped the talisman a bit more tightly in his trembling fist. He had been lucky to have escaped what had followed. The dragon, snarling like a starving panther, had circled above the outskirts of Musilon, watching the fleeing guards. Then it had opened its jaws, and a great sheet of flame had fallen upon the running men. They were turned into living torches by the intense fire, screaming brands that shrieked and howled as they continued to run. The dragon had hovered in the air, turning its horned head with almost bird-like motions, as it focused upon isolated groups of men, before reducing them into charred piles of burnt flesh. Nor did a worm seem inclined to distinguish between the guards flying from Merriman's fortress and the desolate peasants its rampage flushed from their hovels. Even a jaded villain of such experience as Gobineau had covered his ears against the screams and shrieks that sought to drown out the crackle and hiss of flame. Then the dragon had turned its attention upon the miserable hovels themselves, raining its fiery exhalations upon them in a relentless fury. But in this, the dragon was somewhat thwarted, for the mouldering structures were damp with the rot carried to them from the swamp, and they burned only with great reluctance. Only by concentrating its flame upon isolated structures could the dragon persuade them to collapse into heaps of cinder and ash, something the great worm quickly grew tired of. With a last malefic roar that rattled the teeth in Gobineau's mouth, and a sideways glance to ensure that no other scurrying figures remained in the streets below, the dragon had wheeled away, rising back into the smoke and the fiery night sky. In its wake, it left 100 burning bodies lying upon the streets, and 12 fires smoldering in the blackened ruins that had once surrounded Merriman's fortress. Gobineau again thanked Ranald the trickster for bestowing such good fortune upon him. As near as he could tell, he alone had escaped Merriman's castle and the dragon's wrath. Ducking into a small outhouse, the rogue had eluded the dragon's keen eye, and so been spared the fiery death that had run rampant all around him. Then the bandit considered the talisman clutched in his hand. Perhaps it was more than luck. Perhaps the talisman had not only called the dragon, but protected him from the monster as well. Gobineau had certainly been desirous of seeing everyone in the castle destroyed. Perhaps through the fell fang, the dragon had sensed his wishes and simply acted upon them. Marimond, Brunner, neither of them would be troubling Gobineau on this side of Moore's Black Kingdom, and Gobineau had a dragon to thank for such a boon. The power to call such a creature and have it obey his wishes. No wonder Mad Rudel had tried to kill him for the artifact. Gobineau's face split in a sly smile. This was a power beyond his wildest imaginings. It would take some careful thought to decide how best to exploit it. But already several interesting possibilities were stirring in the outlaw's mind.